Hi, my name's Kevin Smokler, and my favorite thing is used vinyl records.
Welcome to the Finding Favorites podcast, where we explore your favorite things without using an algorithm. Here's your host, Leah Jones.
Hello, and welcome back to Finding Favorites. This is Leah Jones. It is Sunday, August 22nd. In 9 minutes, I'm recording an episode of Candy Chat with Jocelyn Gayboy and Scott Smith, which means I made my Sunday morning very busy by not editing this podcast earlier. So I'll keep this intro short and sweet. I'm really grateful for all the kind words, thoughts, and little treats folks have sent me as my breast cancer journey has started. This week I was supposed to have a lumpectomy, and that has been postponed in favor of a few more biopsies to make sure we've got the right approach. So this week instead, I will be having another biopsy on a lymph node. But the silver lining of that delay is I will actually be able to go to synagogue on Rosh Hashanah, and I won't be having a surgery on Rosh Hashanah because I can't handle calendars. This week I have Kevin Smokler on talking about used vinyl. We talk about his documentary. We talk about how he became a vinyl collector. And we talk a lot about the Pointer Sisters. So hit up your favorite Pointer Sisters album. Spoiler alert. They have more than one. I hope that you have been able to convince some folks to get vaccinated as the vaccines get FDA approval soon. Maybe some folks who have been holding out will say yes to the vax. Wear your masks, stay safe, do what you can to take care of yourself and the strangers around you, because we're all in this together. And enjoy this conversation with Kevin Smokler. Hello and welcome to Finding Favorites. I'm your host, Leah Jones, and this is the podcast where we learn about people's favorite things and get recommendations without using an algorithm. Today, I am casting a wider net, my Chicago net, all the way to the West Coast, and I'm really excited to have Kevin Smokler with me today. Kevin is a writer, documentary filmmaker, and event host. He's the author of the book Brat Pack America, a love letter to to 80s teen movies, and the essay collection Practical Classics, 50 Reasons to Reread 50 Books You Haven't Touched Since High School. In 2020, he co-directed the documentary film Vinyl Nation on the contemporary renaissance of vinyl records in America. And it sounds like probably during pre-COVID and during, you can be found in conversations on stage with comedians, playwrights, authors, publishers, and all sorts of people. So Kevin, how are you doing tonight?
Oh, Leah, I'm great now that I'm talking to you. I'm really happy to be invited, and I'm a Midwesterner by birth, so I always appreciate talking to people back in the homeland.
Yeah. I've been here for I've been here like 19 years.
It's about how long I've been in California.
Yeah. What took you to California?
I was trying to, well, it was, I like to say I was out of coasts because I had grown up in the Midwest, gone to college in the East and graduate school in the South.
Okay.
So I was just making a square. And I was actually trying to catch the very first dot-com wave when I arrived in 2020. And there was a lot of people that I had grown up with in Ann Arbor, where I'm from, that were in San Francisco at that point. And then I arrived and the market crashed and they all left. And I was still there at age 27 without a job and without any ties to people I had known from my Midwestern childhood. And I kind of said, what do I do now? And I guess I kind of stumbled and tripped and fell ass backwards into my way, because I'm still here 21 years later.
Outstanding. Yeah. You've made a life for yourself. And are you in San Francisco, or have you moved? You managed to stay in the bubble?
Yes. I'm in my third home in San Francisco, the home I share with my wife. So this is our treehouse. Mm-hmm. I've managed to stay in San Francisco by hook or by crook, and a little good luck and a little purchasing of property, I like to say, via a combination of myself and my parents and the bank and Satan, because nobody buys real estate in San Francisco without Satan.
Yeah. Well, that's why you went to grad school in the South, because that's where all deals with the devil are made.
Yeah. If Robert Johnson has been telling us the truth all of these years, yes, that's true.
Yeah. I had an internship in San Francisco in 1996. Mm. I lived in the Mission.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
I think at like, I'm going to say like 16th and Guerrero, mm-hmm. maybe.
Yeah.
And I worked at a nonprofit. It was that I was on a team helping organize a cross-country bicycle trip. We were like the, it was 1996, so we were, the project was called Bike Aid. It was then with the Overseas Development Network, which, and I think now if it still exists, it's with Global Exchange. And we were the headquarters. And so we would like fax the cyclists who were cycling cross country in 1996 for environmental awareness. We would fax them like maps of their route. Like I would go through an atlas and try and find like safe mm-hmm. roads for them to ride their bike on. And I was always working a couple weeks ahead of them to find like a church to sleep in, a community to make them a meal, making literal clip art, like cutting out things and taping it nicely and doing Xeroxes and sending them care packages of things to have in their pockets to talk about the environment. Wild.
Yeah. There's definitely neighborhoods like this in Chicago, but the Mission is definitely a place in San Francisco where if you move there in your 20s and you don't live in the Mission, people kind of think you've done it wrong. Mm. Like you kind of missed the opportunity to live in the neighborhood where one is supposed to live.
Yeah.
When you're that age. Okay. I was 27 when I arrived. So I kind of figured when I had gone to graduate school, I had a terribly high opinion of myself. I went to graduate school in Austin, and I didn't want to live near UT because like I wasn't an undergraduate anymore. And, mm-hmm. and so I lived downtown. So I had spent 3 years kind of living surrounded by bars and weekend revelers, which is why I didn't live in the Mission when I moved to San Francisco. But the moment you captured there with your internship at 16th and Guerrero is such a moment in time, not because of faxing, but because there are hordes of people our age in San Francisco right now who talk about that precise moment when you were here
as a
golden period, a pre-internet golden period in the history of the city, and bemoan how much we've lost our way since then.
Yeah, it was a really special time. I was 19. I stayed in a hostel my first week there. I didn't have an apartment. Craig hadn't started Craigslist yet.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And I wound up subletting a room from a guy who went on the bike ride.
Yeah.
And my main the few things I remember about that summer are like one great CD he left behind. The band escapes me now, but it was this local duo. I read Confederacy of Dunces was a book he left behind that summer. Mm-hmm. And I failed to care. He left behind an orchid and I killed the orchid, and that was very stressful.
But part of the experience, it sounds like.
Yes.
Like, it would. I feel like I'm not sure the story would have been good as interesting if the orchid had thrived.
No, there was a point where he had called back to the headquarters and said to my boss, "She damn well better not kill the orchid." And I was like, "Why did you leave a 19-year-old with an orchid?" I'm from Indiana. What do I know about orchids?
Exactly.
But it was great. It was a, you know, three bedroom. It was an apartment where the water closet, like the toilet, was separate from the bathtub and different rooms. Like a very, it was great. It was a great time to be 19 in San Francisco for sure.
100%.
Yeah.
100%. I must say I would love to be, I'm not sure I'd want to be 19 in San Francisco now. I would love to be 19 in Chicago right now.
Yes.
Like I think I would get such a kick out of that.
Yeah. Yeah. So do you have any plans yet to come for this summer, or were you able to take any advantage of the dip in COVID to stretch your legs a little?
Some. Yeah. My wife and I were both vaccinated by sort of the middle of May, the end of the second week of May. And we were able to, we decided like we were going to take an adventure and go someplace we'd never been before. But we wanted to do it somewhere where we could drive to it and not hop on a plane. And so we went a couple of hours north to a remote area of the Anderson Valley wine country. That was very interesting. We had never been there before. It sort of has a relationship with the California coast. So if you head 30 miles to the west, you're basically on the windswept rocks of the, you know, up where Mendocino is and stuff like that. My college roommate actually lives in Chicago. So I was in Chicago for 48 hours visiting him. I didn't let anybody else know because it was early June and I was newly vaccinated, and I was sort of easing into spending time with people that were outside of my immediate bubble. Where 6 months later, I would have let everybody in Chicago know I was there. I have done a few things with the documentary I directed. I've been able to go to a few places where Vinyl Nation has been playing in film festivals. Nice. And it's been, you know, with the requisite amount of fear, it's been neat to just see other corners of America after a year, almost a year and change of really only seeing really only seeing one's immediate environs. But my wife and I are going to see my parents on the East Coast in September, and then I have a couple more film festival dates in the fall too.
That's great. So I guess it would be, did Vinyl Nation, did you end up having to do like a digital release, or is the film festival circuit right now, is this the official release of it?
No, we finished the movie right before everything got locked down.
Okay.
And that was right before Record Store Day. So, which is typically in April. So we ended up doing a sort of benefit screening for record stores for Record Store Day 2020, we let them all sell tickets to see the movie digitally, and they kept 100% of the profits. And then we did a digital release of the movie in the summer of last year, because Record Store Day was postponed to three separate Record Store Days: August, September, October. And we did 90 days worth of digital screenings in conjunction with that. And then we're continuing to play on the film festival circuit. And then our thinking is someday in the sweet by and by, when it is safe to do so, we will in fact show the movie in movie theaters, particularly in towns and cities and communities that have been very good to us in the movie, you know, throughout this entire year-long crazy journey.
Yeah. For Vinyl Nation, were you interviewing record store owners, vinyl collectors, musicians, or everyone in between?
All of the above. We actually talked to 45 people, and I think they're all in the movie in some capacity.
Yeah.
And the categories you just named are pretty are the majority of the sort of categories of people we wanted to talk to. The idea for us was to just capture something, you know, something of not only of the comeback of vinyl records, but what the new face of records looks like in America mm-hmm. at this point. So not only what people's relationship were formerly to records, but also young, old, white, not white, male, female, and everything in between. Mm-hmm. Parents and kids, you know, really young people, really old people, something that justified using the word nation in the title, I guess mm-hmm. is the best way to put that. Yeah.
So a census, a national census of people that care about vinyl in 2020.
That's a really good way to put it. Yeah.
Nice. Yeah. I just interviewed Nick Crufting about the Beatles.
Uh-huh.
And he was talking about the experience of getting to hear I Want to Hold Your Hand on a 45. Mm-hmm. And because when it's on the 45, you just repeat it and you hear it over because sure. it wasn't originally released on an album. The Beatles singles were all released on 45s. They weren't part of albums. And he said that when he listened to I Want to Hold Your Hand on a 45 and got to actually understand the experience of buying that 45 and just play it again, that's when he really understood how the Beatles took off. And I thought that was a really interesting insight.
Absolutely. I'm sure this came up in your conversation, but by the time the Beatles landed on the shores of America in February of 1964, it was the culmination of about 3-year effort to break them in America, which up to that point had been largely unsuccessful.
Hmm.
The Beatles were the biggest band in England and could not get arrested in the United States. And so one of the reasons I Want to Hold Your Hand was a single is because no one was going to take a chance on a full-length Beatles album in the United States.
Wow.
So they kept releasing singles on all of these different small labels. And nothing worked, and it wasn't until the Ed Sullivan Show that it actually happened for them. But it's one of my favorite things, and it's why I like your show so much, and it the concept at its very core. You know, I like to say the true story of something you love is mm-hmm. always more interesting than the fantasy or nostalgia or misty-eyed version mm-hmm. of the thing that you like. So it's always better. It's always more rewarding to dig deeper. Even if you find out stuff that you don't like, then you know, and you can take sort of a full measure of the thing that you like. And if you like something that much, it deserves that full measure.
Yeah, it really has been a lot of fun. I started talking to people Memorial Day last year. I really enjoy, there was one couple, there have been a couple married couples where 1 week I'll interview person one and week two and person two. So Taya Lux and her husband, Sean, they felt like I gave them the gift of having someone talk to their spouse for an hour plus about their very deep love of something super nerdy mm-hmm. and like giving them someone new to talk to about it. Which I've enjoyed. And every week I'm like, oh, I guess I have a new hobby. I talked to Keidra Chaney 1 week about K-pop plushies and K-pop dollstagram. And I was like, well, I guess I got to buy a bunch of plushie dolls. I'm into this. So I can't afford to keep up with all the hobbies and bands and movies I'm introduced to. But I really love, I think my favorite thing is hearing the stories.
Yeah, absolutely. So,
well, Kevin, what are we here to talk about this week?
We are here to talk about used vinyl records.
All right. I did not anticipate that being it, but I'm so excited.
Good. Me too.
Used vinyl records. Is that, give me like a synopsis of what that is, and then we'll dig in.
The the record experience, if one has participated in it, you are either the kind of person who is old enough or fortunate enough to have been with records since you began having a relationship with music. And that probably means you're like over 60, or you had very young siblings, or you were just impossibly hip from a very young age. And like, there's probably only a few of those people, if any. And that means you probably, if you are a person who bought records when records were the only game in town, most of your records were probably new and then became used. If you were like pretty much everybody else, when you got into buying records, when records had competition from many other different other ways to listen to music, you are either a person who had 10 brand new records, which represented the 10 most important albums to you in the world. You're impossibly rich and you only buy things new. You may be one of those people, or you're someone who has purchased used records too. And I think that used records are really the version of the record that captures what is beautiful about this moment in time with that particular kind of way of listening to music. The used record is the thing that reminds us that records are, in fact, a relationship with music that connects us to the past, the present, and the future all at the same time.
Wow. So I'm 44 and not impossibly rich, but we grew up with a big record player in the kitchen. My parents had a really good collection. So Janis Joplin, the Beatles. One time my aunt bought my mom a copy of the Pointer Sisters, their big album. And for her birthday. And
oh, you can't say their big album to the guy from the Bay Area. I'm gonna reel off 10 of their big albums now. That's like saying their big album about what's a good Chicago equivalent, like Smashing Pumpkins or Earth, Wind and Fire.
So I guess Jump In, you know my heart.
Oh, okay. So you're talking about Jump for My Love, which is on Breakout, which is a fantastic record. But I'm only doing this because the Pointer Sisters are from Oakland and to my mind, long overdue for the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. Breakout was the 9th or 10th Pointer Sisters album.
It was?
Oh, yes.
Okay.
Oh, yes. So the Pointer Sisters hits from the generation before the ones you and I know, like Jump for My Love, are songs like Yes We Can, you know, Yes We Can, Yes We Can, Yes We Can, Can.
Wow.
I mean, that's actually an Alan Toussaint song that they covered on their first album, but also Slow Hand, I Want a Man with Slow Hand.
That's Pointer Sisters?
I don't think they wrote it, but they're the ones who made it famous. And then Linda Ronstadt made it famous later. And then what else is like from those early Pointer Sisters? Sweet Lover Man, my sweet, sweet, sweet lover man. Anyway, I'm totally off.
So good.
Those are, I am a Pointer Sisters OG road dog.
Do any of them still perform? Are they still with us?
We can get it this late. Part of the Pointer Sisters are a really good example of my relationship with used records. So we'll get into that. But the Pointer Sisters, there are 4 Pointer Sisters and 2 Pointer Brothers. Two of the Pointer Sisters are deceased. Bonnie Pointer died this past year. They stopped performing in 2013.
Okay.
I believe the death of June Pointer, the younger Pointer, hit her 2 sisters very hard. Mm. And I believe they stopped performing at that point.
Okay.
But they, if you've ever heard them interviewed, I think they've done Marc Maron, and I think they've done Questlove's podcast or something.
Okay.
They are the world's greatest interview. The kinds of like famous people you could just listen to talk.
Yeah.
Forever. Their music is really special to me.
Wow.
But we were talking about your parents' record player in the kitchen.
Yeah. So grew up with their, you know, college record collection. We were very dedicated to a music shop called Headstones and Friends in Terre Haute, Indiana.
That's a great name.
It was fantastic. It was, you know, they were obviously deadheads. I'm sure there, it was probably also a head shop, but I didn't know that. You know, just this fabulously dark, like a standalone building, covered in murals on the outside, full of incense on the inside, all albums and then cassette tapes. And I'm from the town where Columbia House Records, the music club. If you ever bought, you know, 12 CDs for a penny.
Yeah, yeah. Was that Terre Haute?
That was Terre Haute, Indiana.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, that's what everybody, like anybody our age, I'm 48, anybody our age who knows of Terre Haute and is not from Terre Haute
knows that story. So, so we, I think because we loved Headstone and Friends so much, we must have bought albums later. And also, when were we finally able to afford CD players? You know, so as a kid, I had I had Dr. Demento and I had Weird Al on vinyl. But then once I went to college, so I have maybe some roommates have had record players since, but so vinyl, other than I've funded Kickstarters for vinyl albums. Like I understand there's, you know, so I have some records that I can't play. So that's, I'm just setting the stage for you, Kevin, of my experience. So when did used records start to become a part of how you were like intentionally getting your music?
Yeah, I actually became a record person, strangely enough, right around the same time that the comeback of records began. Statistically speaking, records begin their upward climb in America again in 2008, and have continued at about 10 to 15% a year since. Exploded during the pandemic, actually. Records are now the dominant way we listen, physical way we listen to music in this country. That doesn't mean that I knew something. I'm not a person who's ahead of trends. That was pure coincidence. Mm-hmm. I was at a dinner party and a guy put on a record. The record was Minnie Riperton's Perfect Angel, a Chicago musician. Okay. And Maya Rudolph's Mom. But And I was just so charmed by the idea of music wafting from the record player into the room that I asked him about it, fatefully, it would seem. And he said, I'm actually getting rid of this entire rig over here, turntable, amplifier, speakers and all, and you can have it for, I think he didn't want to think about it anymore. Right. And he was like, you can have it for $300. And I was like, wow, okay. That seemed like a good deal. I'm not an expert at spotting these sort of things, but it seemed like a good deal. And so I took it home and
Did you take it home that night?
No. Okay. A week or so later. and I took it home and I was like, okay, well now I guess I'm a record person maybe, but and so I called him up and I said, I'm not quite sure what to do next. And he took me to the Amoeba Records in Berkeley, which is actually the original Amoeba Records. The more famous one in San Francisco, which is an old bowling alley, was the second Amoeba Records. The first one was near the campus of UC Berkeley and is still there. And so he took me to the Amoeba Records in Berkeley and he said, what are you interested in? And I said, I didn't really have a good answer for that because I didn't know why I would buy albums that I liked on this, what at the time seemed like an antiquated way of listening to music. Like, why would I rebuy them? That felt like going backwards to me.
Right.
And I said, well, it strikes me that albums, and this is after we've been flipping in the bins for 40 minutes or so, it strikes me that records are cheap. Right. They were, because this was used records before the comeback of vinyl. Right. Used records are not so cheap anymore, but it strikes me that records are inexpensive. So perhaps I should be looking at buying records inexpensively. This was, of course, the days before streaming. This was 3 years before streaming began. Mm-hmm. I should perhaps be looking at records as a cheap way to learn about music that I don't know anything about. And I'll just view records as a way to, you know, be in music community college forever. Like, yeah. it's a cheap continuing education. So this semester will be Latin jazz. The next semester will be female singer-songwriters from mm-hmm. the 70s. And then 90s Detroit techno will be the semester after that, and so on and so forth. And struck me as a wonderful way to learn about music.
Yeah, create your own curriculum. Affordably. Exactly.
Yeah.
And then also collect records in different vibes so that when you have people over, you can just like pull out 10 and be like, tonight is going to be this Detroit vibe. That's what we're going to go for.
Absolutely. And I think I've maintained that lens on record buying and collecting mm-hmm. since. Used records, like I said, are not so cheap anymore.
Right.
We have ways of finding them. We have Discogs and things like that. We have ways of finding them that we didn't before, which is great. Mm-hmm. But I think like I still view records as, and this is why I feel such an attachment to used records. I still feel records as a way to kind of dig deep into an area of music that I'm only kind of surface familiar with. Mm-hmm. I don't typically find records new records, by the way, are not good tools for discovery unless you have endless amounts of money.
Right.
To buy a brand new record by an artist you've never heard of before, unless you just heard them play a concert or something, is not a good use of your
steep
money.
Steep investment. Yeah.
Exactly.
Would you have described yourself as a music guy before the record player?
Oh, very much so.
Okay.
I would not say I was super experimental. My willingness to sort of reach beyond my comfort zone with music has largely been dictated by outside forces. And mm-hmm. in this case, the purchase of a turntable. Before that, in the mid-90s, someone bought me a ticket to the WOMAD tour, the first iteration of Peter Gabriel's tour of world music. And that was the first time I was familiar with this idea that there was music from other countries. I was 22 at that point, so it was a little late for that realization. And then in the early aughts, if you remember Paste Magazine used to come with a CD in the inside where you could learn about 16 bands and solo artists you'd never heard before. So those have kind of been the things that have jolted me unceremoniously out of my comfort zone, musically speaking. I'm always grateful for them. Like,
there's really a window that I bring up from time to time on this podcast for people who are younger than us, where CDs were very expensive.
Yes.
So they CDs for us in the 90s were as expensive as buying a new album today. Mm-hmm. So it's better to get a soundtrack to a movie. Like, mm-hmm. I'm not super into Quentin Tarantino these days, as I've learned how abusive he is, but a Quentin Tarantino soundtrack in the 90s would open the doors to so much music. And so they're absolutely, or hopefully you had a friend who was really good at making mixtapes or mixed CDs for you. But it certainly discovery was more difficult.
Yeah, I think that is a very important lesson that you have successfully, I assume, imparted to younger people, which is that there was a very real point in history. Really, I would say like beginning with the consolidation of commercial radio in the late 1970s, the birth of MTV in 1981, and then the consolidation of record retail 4 or 5 years after that, mm-hmm. beginning 4 or 5 years after that, where records ceased to become something that the average middle-class teenager could buy in mass. And by records, I'm just saying albums, whatever form they come in. They went from being relatively affordable to not so affordable at all. And then the coming of the CD in 1986 was really like the point where, I remember distinctly CDs being talked about as, oh, they'll be cheaper than albums. And that never happened.
No.
So there was really a point that thankfully the internet put an end to, where you had to, if you were a fan of some kind of music, it was like belonging to a gang. you had to choose your gang colors mm-hmm. and defend the loyalty and thing about your gang to the death. Because it's not like you could go to the record store unless you lived in a really hip town and had, you know, a bunch of used record stores and thrift stores and zines floating around and stuff like that. You had to pick your gang and kind of defend it to the death because you couldn't go to the record store and like experiment with a different gang the next week.
Right.
You couldn't afford to do that. And that, you know, I think that created a lot of passion around music, which is fantastic, but it also created this, like, people our age, you know, if we believe that notion that like the musical golden age of one's life is when you're a teenager, mm-hmm. we have this incredibly myopic parochial view of music from when we were a teenager.
Yeah.
I was a hip hop and heavy metal kid, you know, at age 16, like, mm-hmm. do I want to be like a hip hop and heavy metal kid only and like disparaging music played with keyboards at age 48? That sounds like a waste to me. Like,
yeah. So you get a turntable, you start creating your own curriculum for music, and somehow you're slightly ahead of the wave of vinyl, become the vinyl comeback.
Completely by accident.
Did you feel like you were enough ahead of it that you were able to build a solid collection of used records before they started going up in price? Or,
I mean, I think so. I wasn't collecting for the sake of collecting. I think there was a little bit of nostalgia in it. I would really seek out, because apparently nobody wants them but me, but there was a lot of like 80s movie soundtracks that you could get on record relatively cheaply. And I was buying those mostly for nostalgic reasons, but I still have them. I'm really glad I have, you know, the About Last Night soundtrack and the Some Kind of Wonderful soundtrack and three copies of the Pretty in Pink soundtrack.
Because they're great soundtracks.
They are indeed. But all that did was stoke my curiosity. You know, every time all it did was introduce me to more people who were into the hobby, particularly because used records are all about the hunt and the treasure hunt of finding them. All it did was make me more curious, and that has never stopped. So I would say anytime I felt like I'd reached some sort of summit in terms of, my record collection, I would take a deep breath and I would be satisfied for a certain period of time. And then I would be like, okay, what's next? The only difference now is, you know, my wife and I live here and real estate in San Francisco is not cheap. Mm-hmm. And we are not, you know, moving to the sidewalk below while the record, if the records fill up the house. Right. So there's a limited amount of square footage we can devote to records, which means that generally now, if we go on a tear and buy a bunch of stuff, some other stuff has to go.
Yeah.
Which is great about used records are a continuous circulatory system of music. And so they just go back into the bloodstream.
And are you collecting primarily, so 45s are the singles.
Mm-hmm.
And then full albums are 72s?
No, 33s.
Oh, right. Yeah. That's why that whole set of books is called 30. Yep. Mm-hmm. So there are 33s. Are you primarily looking for full albums?
I am a full album person.
Yeah.
Because I like to, just for practical reasons, I like to put the record on and then walk away from it and sit on my couch and read a book or, you know, have dinner with my wife or something like that.
Yeah.
I think 45s are great, but you kind of have to stand there like on one leg, like a flamingo next to the stereo, because it's going to be over in 3 minutes and then you have to flip it over. I have my dad's 45s. I have 300 45s that my father willed to me.
Wow.
I shouldn't say willed, like he's dead. He's still alive. Mm-hmm. My father gave to me. And it's been really great to like chat with him on the phone about the stuff that he listened to mm-hmm. when he was my age and younger, which I've learned about through listening to those 45s.
Yeah.
But I think that's about as far as I'm going to go.
Okay.
With 45s. My dad's former collection that's now mine. Nice. And I have a personal rule that I don't purchase greatest hits albums.
Okay.
Not because I have any issue with greatest hits albums. I just feel like if I'm going to buy a greatest hits in some form, I can probably just plug my phone into the stereo and stream from Spotify. I don't need to purchase a piece of plastic for that reason.
Yeah. Now you did say that the Pointer Sisters and this topic play off of each other.
Mm-hmm.
So talk to me about how the Pointer Sisters, and now I know, a Bay Area band that had a career that was much broader than I knew about. How did they overlap with your love of used vinyl records?
So the Pointer Sisters are a really good example of a couple of different things. One, the first genre that I kind of explored in the act of creating my music curriculum was 70s soul music. So the Pointer Sisters were very much part of that. I lived in the Bay Area, so I was particularly, I live in the Bay Area, so I was particularly interested in music from the Bay mm-hmm. Area at that time. So that's the Pointer Sisters and, you know, latter day Sly and the Family Stone and Tower of Power and that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And when my wife and I moved in together, I found out she was really into that stuff too. So that was a nice coincidence. And the Pointer Sisters are the kind of act where they reached public consciousness, at least for people my age, because I was a little young to know about them, their earlier albums. Mm-hmm. They reached public consciousness at a late point in their career. They're already mature artists by the time you know about them.
Right.
So it's like, if you really dig Breakout, the album that has Jump for My Love and Neutron Dance.
Yeah.
If you're like, man, I really like the Pointer Sisters. Either you say to yourself, this is an exception to the rule. I like this record and I don't need to dig any further. Mm-hmm. But I'm kind of a person who prefers musical marriages rather than one night stands.
Okay.
So, or even, you know, 6 month relationships. Mm-hmm. So I'm like, well, all right, tell me more about this band who I think I really like. And Breakout, which is my first exposure to the Pointer Sisters, was their ninth or so studio album. And it turns out that in the Bay, it is pretty easy to get their first eight used. Wow. There's enough product that they're not too expensive. So I just kind of started at the beginning and worked my way forward. And I've just been, I mean, each of those records I've bought for $5 to $10 in very good condition. Mm-hmm. And I don't love them all equally, but I'm really crazy about all of them.
Yeah.
Like, And that is my favorite kind of music discovery that I think used records lend themselves to really well. Name a band that's had a solo artist that's had a substantial career, but that you only know a little bit about.
Yeah.
But are curious to know more. I think we've all got them.
Right.
And I think, and unless they're an act that, that commands top dollar for their records, meaning they either didn't release any mm-hmm. or they released them all and in that interregnum between like vinyls fall and then come back.
Right.
If you're really into the Replacements, for example, the Replacement stuff is hard to find used.
Yeah.
Because they were, their time as a band was when vinyl was dying the first
time.
Their stuff is very easy to find new and it's very expensive. Or it's pretty expensive new. It's even more expensive used. So it's hard. The Replacements are, that's just timing, you know? But yeah, a band that you know a little bit about and would like to know more about, and there's a lot to know, that's what used records are perfect for.
Ooh. I do think it would be, I think a used record deep dive on either, like I think on Sondheim musicals would probably be outstanding.
Oh yeah, man. Yeah. I mean, because there's like 40 of them, right?
Right.
Yeah.
And certainly plenty of his career was during peak records.
Mm-hmm.
And I also think, so an album we had growing up that I didn't know wasn't just an original album, I grew up with the Bette Midler Gypsy and thought it was just a Bette Midler album. And then I saw Gypsy on stage a few years ago and I was like, wow, I know all of these songs of this musical I've never seen before.
Yeah.
And finally realized that it was because we had the Bette Midler album of Gypsy. Man, Bette Midler would also be outstanding to do a deep dive on, I think.
There's a lot of alleys and cul-de-sacs and forgotten backstreets to that artist's career. Like there's a lot there. Absolutely. This project, if you can call it that, is really rewarding with artists that, you know, perhaps had their moment in the sun, and maybe that moment coincided with a particularly impressionable moment in our lives, and like the one you're describing, and maybe because we were very impressionable at that point, we probably were impressionable for a short period of time, and then we raced onto something else, and maybe we never returned to that thing. I'll give you a quick example. People our age, a band like Depeche Mode was the soundtrack to the high school years of so many people our age. And because it was that, most people our age kind of hopped off the Depeche Mode bus after Violator. Violator, I think, was their eighth album. So the Depeche Mode Imperial period, if you're asking me, which you're not, but it is sort of between Some Great Reward, the album with People Are People on it, the fourth record, to Some Great Reward, Music for the Masses, and then a couple of other records in the middle there, and then Violator. And then most of us are like, and then Depeche Mode, what, poofed in a cloud of smoke?
I have no idea.
So there are seven Depeche Mode records after Violator.
That's shocking.
It is, or it's not shocking at all, because you think about those guys,
right?
And you think about sort of the musical minds that made those records that we are cognizant of. There is a kind of relentless experimentation to them. I mean, those are guys who clearly, I mean, maybe not Dave Gahan, but those, because Dave Gahan is more of like a performer than like a composer. But like someone like Martin Gore is someone who could just spend weeks and weeks in a studio and you would never hear from, and then he'd emerge with 50 songs. So there's no reason to believe that once we stopped paying to Depeche Mode, that someone like Martin Gore would stop experimenting and putting out albums. In fact, he's exactly the kind of person who would just put out records if nobody was paying attention to them.
Last night we were talking, so I have another podcast that I just started called Candy Chat. It's just about candy. But we were talking about Crazy Ex-Girlfriend, the TV show Crazy Ex-Girlfriend, and that Adam Schlesinger co-wrote a lot of the music, and that then my co-host and our guest started going on about, I guess he was a prolific songwriter and pop music.
He wrote That Thing You Do, that song.
And I just had, they both just are rattling off songs, and I was like, what is the secret language you're talking about, you're using? It's a slice of trivia I'm not good at, but it was really eye-opening.
The used record is not a skeleton key to all of these like locked doors and trap doors and sliding panels we're referring to here. Because oftentimes like for an artist like Depeche Mode, whose career began in Europe, and who peaked as vinyl was dying, finding used Depeche Mode records is really difficult. Finding new Depeche Mode records is not so difficult, but they're not cheap. So that's not going to solve the problem of, I want to know more about Depeche Mode, nor is I want to know more about Adam Schlesinger, because Adam Schlesinger as a musician comes of age before vinyls. During the dip. Exactly. However, I think what it does is it keeps us in the frame of mind that you are describing here, which is like that music is something to be relentlessly curious about. Mm-hmm. It doesn't mean we have to be kind of slutty about it. It doesn't mean we have to be like, well, that was an artist I fell in love with on Tuesday. Now it's Wednesday. I don't know their name anymore.
Right.
But it does mean that, like, there's always more than we think there is. Mm-hmm. And we don't have to be content with, like, what happened to them? I don't know. Like, it's like Friends. It's like, listen, if you don't care about the person, like, you don't need to know what happened to them.
Right.
Don't pretend like that, like they vanished in a puff of smoke, like we imagined Depeche Mode did. They didn't. Like,
just because we don't have like object permanence on them.
Exactly. Yeah. Like, and yes, there, most people say that the only song you need by Fountains of Wayne is Stacey's Mom. Mm-hmm. Or maybe that other grungier one that I'm not remembering the name of. But not so with Adam Schlesinger. Like, right. And I think if we like what he does, like that search is part of the fun, mm-hmm. you know, like, the treasure hunt of music, because when we find it, like more music is not like whipped cream or brownies or something like that. Like, more, it doesn't become dangerous to us.
Right. So I'm curious, if take me on, what is a good day of record hunting for you? Are you solo? Is it you and your wife? Are you out with a gang of used vinyl searchers, and so you're all yelling at each other across the store? Is it a new store? Is it your favorite place? What's an ideal day where magically you can go to your three favorite stores? What does it look like?
Sometimes it's with other people. Generally, if it's with other people, I'll be like, okay, let's all go off and do our thing and plan on reconvening in a half an hour, an mm-hmm. hour, and seeing what everybody found. If I'm by myself, I find I'm really attuned to other people in the store. And generally I'm really kind of eager to get into conversations. Like, mm-hmm. everybody who has shopped for records at a used record store before has the experience, particularly then the best time to have it's when you're a new person to the hobby, where you pick up a record up out of the bin and a complete stranger points at you and said, you have to take that one home. And this person doesn't know you and you don't know them. And it's a little creepy because of that. But there's something about the environment where you just kind of, the environment and the magic in the air, and you just kind of trust them. And most of the time they're right, even though they've never met you before. Mm-hmm. And records prompt that kind of, records encourage that kind of communion. I'm sure they're out there. I have never met a record person who's like, my favorite thing about the hobby is, thank God it's 2021 and you can order every record you ever wanted on Amazon, like ordering paper towels, and they just arrive at your door and you never have to go outside and speak mm-hmm. to anybody. Like, nobody views the hobby that way.
Yeah.
Like, everybody views records as a chance, when it is safe, obviously, to be in record stores or any place where records are sold, mm-hmm. and to be with the bins or the crates and with other record people.
Yeah.
So I kind of like those two experiences you're outlining equally. It's a different thrill for each one, I guess. Mm-hmm.
What about, do you ever do garage sales or estate sales, or do you usually head to a record store?
Not intentionally, but I definitely have stumbled across a garage sale, an estate sale, a yard sale, something mm-hmm. like that, and seen people selling records. And because I'm into stuff that people often like think is uncool or are happy to get rid of because it reminds them of a different period in life that they don't want to be reminded of, I'll often find things that are things I didn't know I was looking for.
Yeah. Man, that's great. And it's also, there's also something really special and hard to capture. It's like going into a bookstore mm-hmm. that there is a smell.
Yeah.
Like the smell of a record store that isn't full of incense. That's kind of that, I don't know, that like that is also a special part of it.
Yeah, record stores are very are unique places. Like a good record store will have a unique feeling to it. Like it could only be, you could only be in that place.
Yeah.
A bad record store will feel like anywhere. Like it'll just feel like someone's basement or attic that has some storage containers filled with records.
Yeah. Do you have some favorite shops across the country that you like to hit?
Oh yeah. Like I have favorite shops in pretty much every place I visit regularly.
Yeah.
In your fair city of Chicago, I am really fond. I usually stay downtown just because I love the buildings and the architecture. And I'll usually go to Reckless over on Madison.
Yep.
I'm more accustomed to the Reckless Outpost, the Reckless Records Outpost in Wicker Park, but I just became familiar with the one downtown. So I'll usually spend some time in there. I'll spend some time in Dusty Grooves, which I believe is in Ukrainian Village. And then I just found out, I spend a lot of time in up in Andersonville because I have several friends who live near there.
There's a newish store up there.
Rattleback Records in Andersonville, I'm very fond of too. It's a neighborhood I spend a lot of time in anyway. But
I feel like they recently expanded into the space next door.
I think you're right.
Yeah,
and then there's a record store I just discovered, on the south side, kind of around the corner from the new, you know, where the big park where the African American History Museum is. Mm-hmm. And if you kind of exit the park, the first commercial district you hit right over there.
Yeah.
There's a record, I think at least two record stores over there that I've had some good experiences at as well.
Yeah. Nice. Yeah, I'm in Ravenswood, so kind of halfway between Andersonville and Lincoln Square. And Lincoln Square has Laurie's Planet of Sound, which I'm familiar with just because a number of my friends, that's one of their go-to spots. So
yeah. Chicago is a fantastic record store town.
Yeah.
I mean, I think we're getting to the point where most places with a younger population and, you know, a critical mass of people, and definitely like a college or a university, will have a good record store too. Chicago had a 50-year head start on all of those places. Mm-hmm. But I'm really tickled by how often, particularly making Vinyl Nation, we hear from places like, oh, well, we're Seasick Records in Birmingham, Alabama, and people come from all over the Southeast to shop for records here. And then I see pictures of their store, and I'm like, I believe it, man. I believe it. Or we're, you know, Tone Vendor in St. Augustine, Florida. And it's like, yeah, I get it. These people know who their local community is, and they know what they want, and they know what kind of experience they want out of buying and finding music. And it's great. It's great. It's really, my most fun part about being into used records is you can almost always, wherever you go, like anywhere in the world now, you can always find a place that's got a place you can hunt for some used records.
Yeah. Oh, Kevin, this has been a blast. Is there something about used records, used vinyl that I haven't asked you about that if we hung up, you would regret not telling me?
I would just say this is sort of the public service announcement I give to everybody who is not into records, who is thinking about getting into records, who's new, who's sort of ankle deep at this point. I 100% understand the appeal of a brand new record. A record is an aesthetically a very pleasing object. It's big, it's shiny, it's dark like the night sky. It's bigger than your head. Like it's a very pretty thing. Mm-hmm. And I understand being like, man, I love that record. I want a new copy of it. And I would just say that if that record has sold a bazillion copies over the course of its life, you may want to resist that temptation, because you will in fact get an inferior version of it. If you are dying to have a copy of Fleetwood Mac's Rumors, I totally understand that. You may be the last person on earth who doesn't have it at this point. but if you are dying to have a copy of Fleetwood Mac's Rumors, a record that popular that has never been out of print in the 50 years it's been around, you are better off buying a used copy of it. And the reason is because a record like that will get reissued over and over again by a record label. And each time they will charge you a little bit more and provide you with a little bit less. Unless they list out very clearly on the sticker on front, contains original jacket, reprint of original jacket, original booklet, remastered this way and that way from original, unless they are very explicit about what is in that brand new record, you are paying $45 for a copy of Fleetwood Mac's Rumors that may as well be given to you in a manila envelope. You are better off digging up a copy from the 70s or 80s that's used, which will actually be the real thing.
Right.
And it'll cost you $10 because there's 90 bazillion copies of that record floating around. So that doesn't seem intuitive, but I would just say if you're dying for a nice copy of a record of any one of the top 50 selling records of all time, you're better off buying a used copy of it.
Yeah.
You will get more for less.
And I think it also, I mean, we all treated our records, well, I treated our records very gingerly, but it's a pretty like strong medium. It's up, you know, don't leave it in the car, it will melt. Right. But at some level, it's more about keeping like the needle clean than like, you know, as long as there's not a big gash or it's not warped from being in the heat, like records are pretty strong. Right.
Yeah. If they're shelved properly, if you shelve them horizontally and not on top of each other, if you keep your needle clean, if you use a brush and wipe the dust off the record before you start to play it.
Yeah.
You should be fine. I mean, I would not recommend keeping them in a hot room. I would not recommend, I would keep your cat away from the turntable when it is spinning. Too many of us have made that mistake. And I would just be cognizant of the fact that records, although they last a very long time, are fundamentally a very thin piece of polyvinyl plastic that you could crack over your knee without much trouble. So you just have to be, you have to be careful with them, but if you are, there's no reason why they won't outlive you.
Yeah, this is great. I'm going to tell you one new album story because I think you're going to get a kick out of it, even though it was a new album at the time. When 2 Live Crew was under heat from Tipper Gore, for the album As Nasty As They Wanna Be, one of the life lessons our mom wanted us to teach us was that we didn't believe in censorship.
Yeah.
Government censorship. So my brother had gone out and bought a copy of it for himself, and my mom like gave him $20 and sent him back to Headstone's record, back to Headstone and Friends, to buy her a copy. That the rule was we could listen to it, but not while our parents were home. Then the guys who owned Headstones got quoted in the paper because it was such, I mean, it was such a scare. Like, what a weird summer.
Yeah. I remember that well.
When music was being vilified and rap was being vilified, and 2 Live Crew in particular, and the guys from Headstone and Friends got quoted as saying, "We've even had some people come in and buy 2 copies of it." And that was our family.
That was you. That was us.
Yeah.
That store's still around?
Yes. Yep.
Oh, that's great. I'm glad to hear that.
Yeah. I haven't been in a while, but I made sure to clock it when I was home last time. So it's still there. And I'm sure And it's a college town, so I'm sure that they are on an upswing as well.
Justice is served.
Yeah. Kevin, is there anything you would like to promote? Do you want people to find you on the internet?
Yeah, I can be found on Twitter at Weege, W-E-E-G-E-E, on Instagram at same. And then my movie is vinylnationfilm.com. And on the socials, Vinyl Nation Doc, D-O-C, on both Facebook and Instagram.
Great. I will link to everything and make it easy for people to find you. So thank you so much, Kevin.
Thank you, Leah. This was awesome. Much appreciated.
Thank you for listening to Finding Favorites with Leah Jones. Please make sure to subscribe and drop us a 5-star review on iTunes. Now, go out and enjoy your favorite things.